Welcome to episode 61 of Meenal's World. Thank you all for tuning in again this week. And really don't want to sound like a broken record, but my guest truly is an incredible man. And I know most of my guests are, but each and every one of them deserves a little reminder on the podcast of the incredible work that they're doing. This week, I had the pleasure to sit down with Ian Overton. Now, he's an investigative journalist who has many experiences under his belt. He's won many awards for his work. He's very humble about it, but I managed to suck the juices out of him. We discussed his experiences traveling the world and how he used empathy as a force to share these stories and how important that really is to get into the mind of a person. And we talk about our democracy in the UK and our leaders like Boris Johnson and how even for the most evil of things, and we find our leaders and ministers doing things which we completely disagree with, how we can still find empathy to actually understand why they do these things and use empathy as a way to create change. Now, Ian is very, very humble about everything, as I said, but I'm going to put all of his links in the show notes. I'm going to put out his books. I'm going to put out all of the different awards he's won and the different documentaries he's worked on, because the stories he's shared are so powerful and so moving. And I really hope you get a chance to see his work and read his work. So without further ado, here's Ian Overton. Welcome to the show, Ian. It's so lovely to finally get to speak to you. We've been in touch for some time now, and I know you've been doing some incredible work over the last couple of years. So thank you for giving me your time today.
Pleasure.
How are you doing, Ian? I know the last 2 years have been incredibly busy, but how are you feeling now? Almost 2 or 3 years on.
Well, you catch me on the evening before or the day before I go to the High Court tomorrow with the Citizens, which is this not-for-profit group of collaborative journalists and filmmakers and lobbyists and experts who are trying to sort of make Britain a better place and make the world a better place. And we're taking the government to court at the High Court over its refusal to record and to keep for posterity WhatsApp messages and other encrypted messaging communications that ministers have in government, working off their phones, doing the business of government on things like WhatsApp and Signal, and not recording it for posterity, which means that as journalists, we're unable to properly scrutinize those messages. So we're taking the government to High Court tomorrow. So you're catching me on the eve of a quite a significant moment, I guess, in my journalistic career. There's been a few moments, as a journalist, there's been a few moments through my career where I feel I've had that sort of intersection where there's been a real application of power held to account. Another case was when at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, I led a team that investigated deaths in police custody. And we found that there was a huge number of young black men who had died under suspicious circumstances in police custody, where the autopsy and the coroner's report had claimed that they died from something called sudden death syndrome. This was such a sort of a ludicrous medical claim that we ended up having the entire coroner's report changed. And another instance of I guess where journalism intersects with actual fundamental changes in policy was when I, with a guy called Chris Woods, began to track US drone strikes in Pakistan and the impact on civilians there. And that pretty much led towards a major overhaul of how the United States recorded civilian casualties in conflict. So I feel that this is, one of those high points of a journalistic career where actually you do take the government to the highest court in the land to enforce what is considered by many as an acceptable form of journalistic advocacy. And I think nobody could really argue that we shouldn't have access, or at least we should hold the government to account for using encrypted messaging software where they're messaging their donor friends, maybe messaging people for contracts that don't go through the necessary systems, and all sorts of sort of backroom dealings are now done on WhatsApp that us as journalists and as citizens aren't able to get access to.
Wow, Ian, you mentioned quite a lot of things in the last couple of minutes. So you're going to the High Court tomorrow. This is a case that you've been working on for how long?
Well, so it was in before the pandemic hit. So it was September 2019, I think, that I began to worry that Dominic Cummings, the former special advisor to the Prime Minister, I knew he was operating on WhatsApp, and I knew that there were communications occurring because people on the know had told me. So I put a Freedom of Information request asking if I could have Dominic Cummings' WhatsApp messaging system over a certain contract issuance. And it sort of went round the houses. Initially, they said they couldn't get the data because it was too expensive. Then they said that they didn't have the data. Then they said that I wasn't allowed to see that data because of security issues. And it got into this really tortuous situation that they would neither confirm nor deny that their special advisors were even using WhatsApp, because they said to do so would cause a would allow hackers to hack the very phones that WhatsApp was being used on. All of this ignoring the fact that WhatsApp is obviously owned by Facebook, and nobody's asking whether Facebook might maliciously want to, not that I've got any proof they're doing this, but no, you know, Facebook could be hacked. And as a consequence, should the highest offices of this land be communicating on a platform that's owned by a US media giant?
So you were doing all of this even before the pandemic, because I feel like, because obviously I only met you during the peak of the pandemic 2 years ago. So I didn't know what you were doing before that. But that's really interesting to see how you picked it up before the pandemic. And I assume that during the pandemic, more things started to bubble up to the surface, right?
Exactly. I think the pandemic really was a moment where the so-called sins of the government were revealed in their full sort of truth. I guess it's sometimes when you, in scientific experiments, you apply pressure, whether it's heat or force, onto the item under investigation to establish what it looks like at its weakest, most vulnerable point. And I think the same applies to the British state. When the pandemic hit, it really showed the cracks and the schisms in British democratic accountability and process. The go-to, for instance, with the Conservative Party seemed to be to immediately get on their phones and speak to their mates who had contracts and contacts in China to sort of try and get PPE. But it meant that cronyism suddenly flourished. And yet I think it was always there. What the pandemic did was it revealed these things that were always bubbling under the surface and never truly revealed. And I think in many ways, what it showed is that there were lots of these private conversations being had. These were no longer, brandies in the gentleman's club in Mayfair. These were chats on Signal and WhatsApp between friends who had been at Oxford together, et cetera, where government contracts were issued with a sort of a blasé throwaway idea that, he's a good chap, he can do it, sort of thing. We found very quickly that donors were getting, literally billions of pounds of government contracts through VIP lanes. We found that those companies owned by donors with the Conservative Party giving them contracts were making enormous profits. We're talking in some instances 800 to 1,000 times percentage increases in their profit bases as a consequence of winning government contracts. And all of this was happening on communication platforms that were not allowed to be accessed by journalists under freedom of information laws, because the government had deemed it so that we weren't allowed to do that. So what I kind of realize is that the reason that issues like cronyism and nepotism flourishes in democratic systems is often because they can exist in a world where transparency is frustrated by the powers that be. And I think this was a classic example of the Conservative government repeatedly and systematically refusing to answer questions from me. And I collated all of my freedom of information requests to the government in relation to getting data on FOI and conversations on FOI in relation to contracts issued and things like parties had in number 10 Downing Street. It ran to 166 pages of dense correspondence, which I submitted to the court. Wow. over the course of 2.5 years. And every single request, over 50 requests, were refused for one reason or another. And it seemed to me that the only consistency in their refusal was their desire not to be properly scrutinized and analyzed by citizen journalists. And that just is really troubling to me, because democracy dies in darkness, and this was darkness exemplified.
Ian, I also know what it's like to challenge the government, and I know the stresses that come around with it as well. I just feel like sometimes when you read the news in the media, you just have these really nice glorified headlines, but a lot of the times it does come at a personal cost. It's a very stressful new period to go through to take the government to the High Court. Now, how did you guys fund this case? Because taking the government to court is not cheap in any way whatsoever, because if it was, then we'd all be doing it, right?
So we're remarkably lucky in the Citizens to have people like Carol Cadwalader, who's part of and supportive of it, and really came from her vision. And so she has some really powerful capacity to raise funds simply by putting out funding calls on Twitter, because she has a large following base of people who are like-minded, who want to sort of support transparency and democratic accountability. So we do it through crowdsourcing. We also teamed up with a public interest law firm called Foxglove, who also raise money through crowdsource funding. And I think this is the very interesting element, actually, of where philanthropic journalism may be headed, is that in the past, journalistic projects were usually held by large media organizations. And as a consequence, journalism was, to some degree, a slave to the political decisions and whims of its proprietors. They began to see an increase in public interest journalism and research advocacy, where it was sort of charities doing this, and you saw sort of the rise of groups like Transparency International or even investigative powers like Human Rights Watch that were raising money through philanthropic funds. But these were still reliant on large philanthropic donations. So you still got enormous groups like Soros, for instance, incredibly generous, but he's giving large amounts of money to investigative units to do his work. And of course, there comes a bit of a power nexus in that in itself. And I'm not discrediting large philanthropies for funding, but there still is choices as to what they decide to fund and what they decide not to fund that are made by other philanthropic boards. Whereas what we're entering now, I think, and we're seeing not just with Foxglove and the Citizens, but we're also seeing it with the Good Law Project and other groups such as Open Society, Open Democracy, sorry, who are raising money through crowdsource funding. These may be £10, £15 given by concerned citizens who feel an issue is of particular concern. And that cumulatively may turn into £50,000. And then that can fund units themselves. So I think we are seeing a bit of a shake-up in the way that journalistic, investigative journalism particularly, process is being funded. And I'm really honoured that anyone would even give £5 to a project like holding the government to account over WhatsApp usage, because it's quite a sort of it's not the boldest of headlines. WhatsApp use, some people may say, well, why do we really care? They're just messaging each other with GIFs, or how do we know that it's just not banter, etc., etc. But that doesn't, that's not the point. I'm not really interested in, you know, gossip in Westminster between what might be being said on certain WhatsApp channels in a kind of a lighthearted way. What it concerns me is that we've gone from a situation where the civil service had very large levels of control in terms of recording and annotating and keeping for posterity the correspondence of government. Whereas today, my concern is that a huge amount of the correspondence of government is very quickly deletable on private phones, isn't being captured. And if you are a historian today of, let's say, the Victorian period, you would be able to see the densely written notes of Gladstone or Disraeli and the letters that they wrote, and everything was recorded and kept. And we got a real sense of the politics of the day through these tightly written letters. Whereas today, I think if you looked at the correspondence of Boris Johnson, you'd think that the man never corresponded with anything apart from a couple of appearances on television, which he rarely gives interviews, because it doesn't seem as if there's a huge amount of pen put to paper. These are, you know, throwaway WhatsApp messages sent to all and sundry. And by the way, Boris Johnson's mobile phone has been out there for quite a considerable amount of time in the public domain. So who knows which other intelligence services aren't listening in and reading his messages. But the truth of the matter is that his messaging and the messaging of his ministers are not kept. And as a consequence, it does just pose a profound challenge toward democratic accountability if we're never really to know what is being said by whom, when, and how.
Now, Ian, I spoke to George Monbiot a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, and one of the interesting things that he said to me was that because he studied in Oxford, and he felt like he didn't really fit into that crowd. But what he did at that time was he used his knowledge from how those people who go to these Oxbridge colleges, how they think and their outlooks on life and their perspective and how they actually get things done and how they make their way up this ladder into parliament. He used that to actually hold them to account through his job as a journalist. Now, I know you studied in Cambridge. What was your experience like at that time? I mean, were you fully aware as you are now with what was happening in the world? Is this something you've always wanted to do, or did it only come out as you started working as a journalist?
So I was, my father was in the military, and we were posted all over the world. So at the age of 8, my parents were posted to Hong Kong, and they sent me to a boarding school back in England. And so from the age of 8 to 18, I was in this very, very staid, highly controlled environment of a Victorian-style public school in Canterbury. And then straight off the back of that, I went to Cambridge, where, again, it was a very formal, institutionalized environment where there were lots of ex-public school boys and girls there. If truth be told, it was very easy, or it's very hard sometimes if you're indoctrinated and initiated into a culture to see beyond that culture and see it critically. And I began to see it critically in Cambridge because I began to hang out with people who were not at all from the world which I'd spent the previous 10 years. So I did a lot of charity work. I ended up heading up the university RAG, they called it. I did a lot of acting, and I did a lot of other forms of sort of creative output. And that just brought me in contact with a lot of people who, you know, came from very, very different backgrounds to me. And I never came from a rich household. We lived in a semi-detached in Sidcup. But because the military helped finance me going to a private school, I had this what is conceived as a very privileged upbringing. But I don't see it as an upbringing of privilege in the strictest sense. I see it as quite a traumatic upbringing, because being sent away at the age of 8 was traumatic. But also I saw it as traumatic because I ended up having to exist and live next to people who I think were the who now form some of the bedrocks of conservatism in this country. And I think some of their views were very, very toxic. And I was exposed to these views from an early age. For instance, I remember very distinctly one guy called Tim walking down the street, looking at a group of kids from a local comprehensive and calling them peasants. And I just didn't understand where this anger had come from, because my own personal family background was an antithesis to the sort of public schoolboy, you know, upper middle class background that you often see in Britain, because my grandparents were Peruvian, and my mum had just gone to a local school and my dad hadn't gone to university. So, I mean, I didn't really have a great sense of that kind of class prejudice in my own household. So when I was indoctrinated into this class prejudice in Britain and in Canterbury, it just rested really badly in my throat. And the other thing that which I witnessed, and I think this does go on to the culture that Monbiot is talking about at Oxford, I witnessed terrible bullying. I witnessed the sort of bullying that boys almost killed themselves because of the harm wrought to me, both physically and psychologically. And I always stood up for the bullies, but by standing up, people didn't bully me, but I was never part of the cliques that were the elite, so to speak, of the school. So I like Monbiot, I did feel like a boy apart at school. I didn't feel necessarily a man apart at university, because I hung out with a lot of people who were very into charity work or acting, and so it wasn't as toxic. But having said that, the thing that really struck me about both the college I went to and the school I went to is that ultimately they were designed in the 19th century to create men, largely men, to go into the world and become basically the governors of empire. So there was this underlying notion throughout it all that you were a gilded few who were destined for great things in your life through heading up industry, or more importantly, in the kind of Victorian sense, had we been alive 70 years before, 100 years before, we would have all been sent off to be sort of district governors in India, etc. Now, obviously, the death of empire didn't mean that those ambitions towards global dominance were suddenly snuffed out. And what I think that has happened is that the generation that I came up with all became lawyers and accountants and actuaries and sort of financial professionals. But what they did is they all embedded themselves in the London financial markets and offered services to countries which had less democratic accountability and often were governed by oligarchs and despots, like the Russians, for instance. And they ended up, after graduating from Cambridge, going and working for these individuals. So I know lawyers who worked for Abramovich, who worked for Deripaska, who worked for other Russian billionaires. I know lawyers who work for the Koch brothers in the United States, the far right businessmen, or the right wing businessmen, should I say, in the United States. And it struck me that all of these men, who I once considered friends and spent a lot of my life with, basically, in order to afford the lifestyle where they themselves can send their children to the very boarding schools that corrupted them, go and do jobs that I categorize as what I would call the devil's butler. That these are service industry jobs, professional jobs, where they will do the bidding of anyone, no matter what the origin of their wealth is, provided that they get paid enough. So you've got these individuals, friends of mine, as I said, who would be on £300,000-£400,000 a year working for London legal firms, working for individuals who definitely had corrupt pasts, whose money was tainted. So there's this sort of terrible self-reproducing logic of Britain's elites, where they don't necessarily enjoy being sent away to school at the age of eight or whatever, but they will do it to their children because they're so indoctrinated into that's how leaders operate, and it's good for you. That's the notion. So in order to afford these lifestyles where they're having to spend £90,000 a year or something on private school fees, plus they feel it's their God's given right to live in Fulham and have a house there which costs £3 million. So they work out that they need to be earning hundreds of thousands of pounds a year in order to achieve this standard of life, in order to reproduce the life that they themselves have inherited. And the outcome is that they are willing to work with whoever it takes, who will pay them the sort of money that enables that. And given that the UK doesn't have large industry, what it means is that they end up looking globally for great industrialists to sort of and other wealthy individuals to see how they can offer services to them. So, you know, you get British lawyers being the legal counsel to Russian oligarchs. You get British accountants being the financial advisors to Middle Eastern despots, etc., etc. And it's, I think, ultimately that this is a consequence of late capitalism, where the money that we see evidenced in London is so distanced from its origin, where it may have been bathed in blood or framed by human rights abuses, that we don't see any moral problems with that. And in a way, I think that the ultimate situation is that the product of public school and Oxbridge is an imperialistic mindset that is seeking to find systems of earning that mimic empire but isn't empire. And this is why I think London is the go-to for oligarchs and despots around the world, is that these individuals are acting almost in a quasi-imperialistic way, these professional services, seeking the funds of whoever arrives at their table. And they do so with moral impunity. And they can go home and lie in their beds at night and feel content that they're not part of the great palms of the world, because they themselves haven't traveled to the places where the money has come from. They haven't gone to the slums of Delhi. They haven't looked at the corrupted earth of northern Russian industrial towns. They haven't visited prisons in China or looked at mining corporations operating in the Philippines. Now, I've done all these things in my life. I have repeatedly traveled to the edges of the world to look at human rights abuses. And I've done so with the exquisite knowledge that, ironically, I'm doing exactly what my training taught me to do. My actions of traveling the world looking at human rights abuses is a form of imperialism in itself. I am product of my upbringing. But I hope and I pray that I've managed to do that traveling, that international journeying, which is very kind of public schoolboy, and I get that. But I hope and pray I've done it with a very compassionate heart, searching for empathy, searching for justice, and searching for accountability.
Well, Ian, I'm just thinking about it as you were saying it, that, you know, in our cultures, in like the South Asian culture, especially for people like myself who are second generation in this country, we talk a lot about generational trauma because our parents led a very difficult life to actually bring us to the stage of becoming doctors or lawyers or accountants, whatever we are now. But I think that generational trauma can also be applied to the white British man as well in some way.
It is. It's a very difficult one to articulate in a way, because obviously the go-to is one should always be critical of the mechanisms of power. And yes, I am profoundly critical of the individuals who are the products of the very upbringing I endured. But it sounds strange, as I am massively critical of Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister. But I am deeply sympathetic to Boris Johnson, the boy, the 10-year-old boy who was sent to boarding school, who had a very fractured relationship with his mother, who seems throughout his life to be still acting like a little boy desperate to be seen by the world. And it's very difficult to articulate empathy for people of privilege. And I think therein lies the problem, is I've always argued that these individuals, myself included, we are damaged. We are damaged by the institutions that are infused with a militarism and also a callous regard for any form of humanity and love. I mean, being sent away to a boarding school at the age of 8 is an unbelievably traumatic experience. And yet, you know, that happened to me, it happened to George Monbiot, but it also happened to huge numbers of people in the Tory party. And yet, whereas Monbiot and myself are able to properly scrutinize that trauma and try to hold it to account in all the forms it took by being journalists, the majority of people don't want to address their trauma because it's so painful, and so seek to reproduce it, because by reproducing trauma, you make it acceptable and no longer traumatic. You make it a sense of life. But I think that if we approach this elite framing of education and empowerment through the prism of you were abused and you are the product of abuse, I think it would actually have a stronger revolutionary impact, a stronger reformative impact, than simply just to throw cabbages at the elites and say, you're privileged and be damned. So actually, I do think that empathy is the weapon of reform. That, you know, without properly understanding what brings people to locations, one never truly understands, you know, their backgrounds and therefore why they commit the sort of things they do. And this is something that goes through all of the journalism I've ever done. My last book was about suicide bombers. And what I wanted to investigate is, why do people blow themselves up to create a utopia that they will never inhabit? And what are the sort of psychic wounds that some of these individuals may have that leads them that decision that the only way towards a better society is through their own deaths? And so I'm always interested in hidden traumas, in hidden narratives. And it's a profoundly difficult journey, really, as a journalist, to continually want to investigate pools of silence, which is what I do. So on the one hand, I'm asking the government to release its WhatsApp messages because these are pools of silence. But on the other hand, I'm also psychoanalyzing Boris Johnson for the trauma he suffered as a boarding school boy. But I'm also looking at what causes and in terms of other things I investigate, so I'm currently investigating Britain's special forces, these elite groups who operate in the shadows. I'm continually dragged into shadow land investigations in my work, because I believe that it's in the shadows where that's where truth truly lies and understanding and is really born. Because if you only see the superficial of things and report on things in a superficial level, you never truly change anything. And I think that's the fundamental difference between investigative journalism and regular reporting. Regular reporting just relays the news of the day, whereas investigative journalism seeks to penetrate the pools of silence created by power structures and designed to prevent people like you and me to properly hold individuals and societies to account.
Wow, you know, I never really thought about the mind of a suicide bomber until you just mentioned it. I mean, that sounds very fascinating, especially as someone who's a doctor, because as doctors and GPs, we see lots of different people from different parts of society. And you made a very good point about empathy being such a crucial force in creating change. And I just always talk about anti-vaxxers, for example. In the last few months, you know, we've had people come to us asking for their opinion on vaccines, and it doesn't happen overnight that we manage to convince them. But for some people, you know, 6-7 months down the line, they've decided they want to get the vaccine. And the more you talk to them, the more you realize that actually they've had a very complex past and a complex history, which has led them to make these decisions.
So I'm currently doing a PhD, which is I'm submitting my two books. So my first book was about gun violence around the world, and my second book was about suicide bombers around the world. And I wrote both books because I looked at the great panoply of what causes the greatest harm to civilians. And the greatest harm to civilians is caused by guns. So I wrote a book about guns. And the second greatest harm in terms of conflict to civilians is caused by improvised explosive devices. So I looked at suicide bombers. But one thing that I'm sort of examining as part of my PhD is how do we, as journalists, as physicians, as humanitarians, penetrate this space between our understanding of the world, which is often rational, and the irrational, which is often seen in spaces of extreme violence. So a suicide bomber is irrational, a mass shooter is irrational. But how do we even begin to approach an understanding of them in order to then, hopefully, through articulating an empathy and a framing of them, find ways in which we can potentially in the future address what the drivers that led to them, to those places of madness, and in so doing, prevent those drivers from existing. And the thing that I've alighted on, and this is the challenge of empathy, is that sometimes it's actually in the moments of things which are truly confusing, that's the point at which I alight upon as being the most interesting. So, you know, why does an anti-vaxxer fundamentally believe that somehow injecting themselves with this or being injected with this vaccine would enable them to be tracked by the CIA, for instance? Yeah, that to me is, other people would dismiss that as lunacy, but to me, I go, that's fascinating. Why do you think that? So in my first book about guns, I was fascinated why I kept on seeing zombie posters in mid-American gun shows. And it struck me that the zombie was representative in a way of a kind of a perennial existential fear of the permanent threat to one's self and to one's health in American capitalist society. So in a way, the zombie was both constructed by the gun manufacturers to create a permanent notion of the fearful presence of the other, but it also touched on quite deep-rooted psychological drivers in American society, where the other is consistently represented in a fearful way. So it both served a tool to the marketeers, but also fed into an underlying concern in the gun buyers. And that's why the zombie is so popular in American culture. In the suicide bombing book, I was fascinated by why so many young Salafist jihadists would believe that they would be the recipient of virgins in paradise. And what was it about virgins in paradise that spoke to them? And because it just seemed so irrational. And yet when you really unpicked it, you began to see there were concepts of polygamy, there were concepts of young men not being able to afford to have a wife, there were concepts of sexual frustration, there were concepts of the othering of what a virgin would look like, there were concepts of gender roles at play, there were lots of other elements at play. And so the zombie and the virgin in my two books really were the entry points for me to understand quite profound, complex, and what superficially looks like madnesses, but actually are rooted in relatively rational responses to circumstances that most people do not encounter. So, violence is in itself a form of madness. But interrogating violence, I think, means we have to sit down and scrutinize those moments of madness that reveal themselves most most visibly. So, and in a way, that this is the job of the investigative journalist. So, I believe that the way to enter the mindset of Boris Johnson is to look at him as the little boy being sent to Eton. My belief to understand a Salafist jihadist is to look at his relationship with his mother and potentially the promises or the failings of promises for him to have a full and wholesome family life. The interesting element of trying to understand Midwest Western gun shows, I think you have to always appreciate that, you know, these are often Scottish immigrants from years and years before who are fleeing despotism in Britain, who were, you know, have got this narrative of fear of big government and fear of the despot that is evidenced in the zombie in their gun shows. So all of these understandings require you to find some other entry point, often hidden in time and space, to get a better understanding of the here and now. But the reason I'm taking the government to court over WhatsApp is because in order to understand these sort of abhorrent moments or these aberrations in culture, you need to have access to the data itself. So, transparency is the first hurdle to overcome in investigations. And then the second hurdle to overcome in investigations is empathy. So, you know, get the data and then scrutinize it with an empathetic eye. And that brings you closer towards understanding and some form of revelation.
What was your experience like, Ian, when you were writing the book about suicide bombers? Did you travel to these parts of the world to speak to them personally?
Yes, I did. So in both books, I traveled extensively to areas of quite significant conflict. So with the suicide bomber book, I traveled to Sri Lanka, which saw the Tamil Tigers. I went to Lebanon, where there were a quite significant number of suicide attacks, both by Iranians and Lebanese communists, and also other groups that were seeking to kill Israeli soldiers there. I traveled to Palestine and Israel, because obviously there's a huge number of suicide attacks there. I went to the 9/11 memorial in United States. I traveled to ancient shrines dedicated to kamikaze warriors in Japan. So I did a huge amount of traveling. And I even went to, in the UK, I went to Bradford because there are parts of Bradford which have produced a number of suicide bombers who have gone overseas to die fighting for the Islamic State. So a lot of my investigative journalism is sort of a combination of A, starting with the data, B, traveling to the locations where these events occurred to try and get a deeper understanding of the psychogeography, if you will, of the place where they went, and then C, to try and interview as many individuals who may have been involved in this. So, you know, for instance, I traveled to St. Petersburg in order to visit the church where it was built on the site of the world's first ever suicide bomber that happened in 1881, where this group of Russian revolutionaries called the People's Will killed the Tsar of Russia when one young man called Gravinsky blew himself up and killed the Tsar of Russia in so doing. And it was, you know, it's a combination of going to the location in order to try and have a deeper empathy with the events that occurred there, but also aligning that with, you know, systemic scholarly reading, many, many interviews, examination of the data, and a whole series of other approaches to try and get, I guess, a constellation of evidence that then can be brought together to sort of, you know, give a more comprehensive understanding as to why something occurs.
You know, you mentioned that you went to Bradford here in the UK. Shamima Begum just comes to mind. And, you know, you're talking about understanding the past experiences of these people who get pulled into these extremist views. What are your thoughts on Shamima Begum now? And I mean, the last thing I read about her was that she wanted to come back to the UK and she regrets everything that she's done. What are your thoughts on such a young girl being pulled into something so innocently? Well, I mean, I'm saying innocently. I don't really know what it was like for her at that time.
Well, I mean, one of the challenges ultimately of what happened in 9/11 is that 9/11 implicitly, by its terrible, terrible act, killed all the perpetrators. So everyone involved intimately in the capturing of those airlines died in the attacks. And the entire Western basis of judicial accountability is that the person who commits the murder is then held to account by the state and justice is seen to be applied to the murderer. But what happens if in suicide bombing, every single time the suicide bomber strikes, they distance themselves from Western framings of judicial accountability because they're dead. They can't be held to account. What that means is what happens is both the media and the state immediately wanted to punish the networks that supported those suicide bombers. So we went to war in Afghanistan and then we went to war in Iraq in an attempt to punish, often erroneously, the systems that held them to account. Now, the problem with that is that when you begin to extend in a critique of the communities that supported an individual, all of a sudden you get this situation where the alignment of outrage isn't on extremist Salafist jihadists who hold a particular form of belief system where the fatwa of Mardin by Ibn Tamaya is held to account, and that is why the East Coast of America should be bombed. You know, a very, very small group of individuals with very esoteric theological views who have been driven to violence, which is Al-Qaeda. That is too nuanced to understand in the rubble of Manhattan. And so what people alighted on is that this was perpetrated by Muslims, okay? And all of a sudden you got these anti-Islamic headlines throughout the Western press, and almost as if the war was framed as a kind of a great battle, a clash of civilization, so to speak. It escalated from a small group of Salafist jihadists to entire countries being attacked. And I don't excuse what the people who went off to fight for Al-Qaeda or ISIS or any of these other groups did. It's not an excuse, but you cannot but look at their decision to go and fight without looking at the sentiment that many of them felt, that they were a community under attack. They were living in a country, particularly the Europeans who traveled to countries to fight. They were living in Western Europe, where the general mantra was that they were that Muslims were bad and Muslims were violent and Muslims were the cause of everything. And if someone critiques your entire cultural framing, particularly if you're young and still molding your worldview, I'm not surprised that a lot of these young Muslim men and some women in places like Bradford did feel that they were a community under attack and did feel they had to go and defend the wider identity that they held. So, you know, the rise of conservatism and Islam is to some degree a direct response to the rise in Western attacks on notions of Islam. And it really bothers me, actually, how so often the British press just refers to people as Muslims, but they wouldn't refer to people as Christians. They'd refer to people as Protestants or Catholics. They would give sub-denominational references to their religion. But we don't talk about Deobandis or Sufis or Sunnis or Shias in any detailed understanding of what it means to be a Muslim. And, you know, it took me a lot of reading of the, Quran verses and other Islamic texts to understand actually just how varied and disparate and multi-representational the world of Islam is, just as the world of Christianity is. But it requires an effort to go away and do that. And I think when you realize that it is much more complex, and then you read lazy headlines in some of the tabloids or the mid-range papers in the UK that are highly influential, but lazy headlines like a quarter of Muslims believe in jihad, and they haven't explained what Muslims mean, they haven't explained what jihad mean, and they haven't explained where the framing of the question is, then all of a sudden you can see why people who see themselves as devout Muslims devout Sunnis and devout Shias, whatever, they might read those headlines and suddenly feel that they are a community under attack. And any community under attack will invariably produce from its legions people who will want to go and fight to protect that. Now, this isn't meaning I support those individuals who traveled from Britain to go and fight in Syria, but it means I think you come to some space of understanding why they wanted to.
Well, Ian, I mean, after everything that you've mentioned, I can see that you've traveled extensively. You've seen so many different cultures, so many different religions, so many different perspectives. How has it been for you to sort of absorb all of this information and then look at the world and see the things that are happening around us? I mean, we look at Russia, Ukraine now, but obviously before we had the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and so many innocent people their lives are on the line due to either the negligence or the decision-making of the leaders at hand. And you're investigating all of this. And from what I can see, you're not stopping. You're going from the one thing to the other and you're working so hard. And how do you just take a moment to sort of take care of yourself as well? Because you need to take care of your own energy and not burn out, really.
Well, I mean, I've often thought about this. And of course, the fundamental element is that this is my choice. I've been to Ukraine 5 times in recent years to report on the conflict that's been going on there since 2014. And every time I went to the front line and reported on the harm to civilians there, I felt blessed that I had a home to come back to, children to come back to, a life to come back to in Britain, where they were not a threat. So I think it's a question that often gets asked of me about, like, how does repeatedly going to conflict zones, and I've been to 24 conflict zones, what effect does it have on me? And my answer is that I am the least important person in the room when it comes to that issue. That the people who are truly the ones who are traumatized by conflict are the ones who cannot escape. I can go in for 2 weeks and leave and come back to the safety of London, but and where I live in an area that isn't beset by knife crime, and I'm blessed in that sense. But I think it's interesting that my uncle was a priest and my father was an army officer and my brother's an army officer. So clearly I come from a family where notions of public service is quite deeply rooted in our familial framing. And my mother was a physiotherapist. And I do think that, this is not a job, it's a calling, it's a life, it's a dedication. And the journey which I've conducted is the realization that every single death deserves to be accounted for. Everyone deserves the dignity of their death to be counted. And I sit on the board of this amazing charity called Every Casualty Counts, that lobbies exquisitely for that. But this is a kind of a realization, actually, I'm alighting on, possibly as a consequence of seeing trauma in lots of different locations, is that even if I help the memorial of one death, even if I highlighted that X or Y had not been reported, at least that's me adding, I'm not going to change the world on my own, by no means. I don't have that utopian belief. But I do believe that I can add a little bit to the great, a panoply of knowledge. And for instance, in 2020, there were over 150 murders in London. But 16 of those murders, we do not know the name or the ethnicity or the gender or the race or the age of the individual who was killed. And I find that profoundly traumatic, that people can be murdered in London and not even their identity is captured. I'm embarking on this investigation at the moment of examining just how many people the British military have killed in operations overseas. Over 350 in Afghanistan, over 150 in Iraq. Dozens and dozens of people killed, it seems, by Royal Air Force strikes in Iraq and Syria. Now, I think that there's a moral imperative that these individuals, if not named, are at least accounted for, their numbers are tallied. And I find it particularly egregious that our prime minister is standing up, berating and critiquing the Russian state for its killing and attacking of civilians, which it the prime minister should do that. But simultaneously, the prime minister should also be creating a civilian casualty recording unit in the Ministry of Defense that records the people our own troops kill. Because, you know, how can we possibly critique another if we don't do it ourselves? And I think the ultimate thing that drives me through my life is a profound hatred of hypocrisy. That if you have power and you claim to be doing this or critiquing that, then you better have your, you better be clean. Because if you're not, then you're a hypocrite. And I think that that's the driver that pushes me through. And that's the solace I find and the empowerment I find in the work I do. And I think if I was merely a mute witness to the horrors I've seen throughout the world, I would be dragged down by it. But I don't feel I'm a mute witness. I feel I have an active participation. And just as I can articulate and critique the death of an individual in Iraq or Syria and highlight the harm that that brought, just as you, you know, can treat a patient who without your care would die, you know, I think both of us are faced with trauma, but both of us are also equipped, me with words and you with your medical knowledge, with the capacity to intervene and change that individual's life for the better, if possible. And that's all I strive to do. And I don't really contemplate too much about myself in that. And I think that's why, you know, I mean, obviously, one, you know, I try and exercise and all the rest. But I think ultimately, if I spent too much time thinking about myself, it would be like a doctor sort of having to sit down after every single time they had to tell someone they had cancer. You know, how do I feel about that? But, you know, people, we don't do that. And if it's a calling, you know, there has to be a greater imperative at stake.
Yeah, Ian, you gave me a pretty important moment of reflection just now. And obviously, over the last 2 years, with what we've seen in the pandemic and everything I went through to hold the government to account in the legal case, it was very overwhelming for me in many ways. And I think part of that was probably because I gave birth in between all of that. And you know, we had a baby and life changed in many ways for me. But I think now that I look back at it, I realize that perhaps the thing that frustrated me the most is exactly what you just said, is that every death is important. And it felt like the media, along with our leaders, almost forgot about it. Even now to this day, with the news lines and the headlines changing, people are not talking about it. And you're right, every death does count. And it's our jobs, it's our roles as journalists and as doctors to respect that and honor everybody who's gone through this difficult time, but also for their families as well, because they're the ones who have to live through the next 10 years, 20 years, their children have to, their grandchildren have to live with this in their mind that, you know, their relatives have died in a needless or senseless way.
Exactly. I mean, death is inevitable, but the circumstances, the timing of our deaths is not. And the problem I really have with the current crisis in Ukraine is the way that it is being, to some degree, used by the British political establishment to distance themselves from the huge amounts of public outrage that was had over their own, both handling of the pandemic, but also their own personal responses to the legal stipulations wrought by that pandemic in terms of having parties, etc. And it almost seems as if this is a frivolous discussion to be had in the face of bombardments in Mariupol. But to me, there is the very erosion of democratic accountability that that led towards Putin invading Ukraine. You know, if you look at the what Putin was like a decade ago, you know, he unaccountable. The tragedies he wrought were not held to account, and he considered himself a man apart from the people. Well, you know, that would apply to Boris Johnson. I'm not saying that Boris Johnson will go on to become Putin and will invade a country, but democracy has a habit of being eroded when it's not cared for and tended. And I fear that the noise of Ukraine, whilst it is important to maintain and to hold Putin to account, I think that that noise should coexist by a similar critique of the British government's handling, both of the pandemic, but also other things as well. I mean, we're talking about the pandemic, and that's hugely important. But, you know, we're seeing record levels of distance between the wealthiest in this country and the most impoverished. We're seeing huge price increases on basic items of food. We're seeing, you know, petrol pump rises. And all of these things will impact the poorest in our society so deeply, terribly and hard. And I just do not feel that there is a government there that has been in power for 12 years and yet constantly seems to be arguing that, you know, they will do better. Well, why haven't they done better yet? Why is poverty so endemic? Why are people living literally on the breadline and having to go to food banks? And these sorts of egregious realities in British society, you know, are allowed to exist because of distractionary tactics by political figures who will want to point at other things rather than address the cancer at the core of the society they are meant to be tending.
I already had a lot of respect for you, but after this interview, it's definitely amplified. And I'm so grateful for people like yourself who are working so hard to bring truth to the people, but not in just a journalistic way, but in a very practical way as well, like you're taking the government to the High Court tomorrow. I'm sure a lot of people listening in today are aspiring to be journalists or are journalists and probably feel inspired by the work that you do, but they probably feel a bit scared of the implications that probably come along with holding people to account, because it's not easy to do that. You are, to some extent, putting your job on the line and putting your career on the line as well. It is a risky thing to do, but what would be your advice to people like that?
I mean, I think we, the lot of young journalists can enter the environment and suddenly find themselves faced with having to make quite strong moral choices where they have to pay the rent and then they have to get jobs, and the jobs they end up getting, they may be very strong editorial pressures on them to do those sorts of jobs. And so you may find, for instance, somebody with strong high ideals of wanting to be a good investigative journalist ends up working for a paper. I won't name any papers, but, you know, a paper where they end up having to do fashion news or gossip news or even worse, to report on things that are then so radically twisted to become almost the opposite of what the truth is. And to those journalists, that I think is the hardest journey. My journey is easier simply because I'm of an age where I managed to buy a place in London and can now afford to live in London and do the work I'm doing. So I'm blessed. The cost of living and the challenges that brings to young journalists is the biggest challenge towards being able to do the sort of journalism that they want to do, because they may have to make moral compromises just to pay the rent. And I think that's the greatest tragedy in many ways, how to do that. And the only answer I have for that is this, is that, yes, you will work Monday to Friday and you'll be exhausted. But if you really want to apply yourself, then you'll have to work on the Saturday and the Sunday to do the journalism that you believe in, to write the book that you believe in. And, you know, recently, I just as you're very, very kind and generous in your praise of me, but I have equal praise for you, Doc. And I'm so pleased that my daughter has just gone into medical school. And I sat down with her and I said to her, you know, it's going to be a long journey for you. It's going to be hard. You're going to work really hard hours. But, you know, I said, but what you need to do is have a political framing that, you know, you believe in the longer arc of your journey in life having an impact on people. And it could be that you get dragged down by the bureaucracy and you're let down by the institution that's supposed to be supporting you. And it could be that, you know, you find at 3 a.m. when you're on your third call of the week and you haven't slept and you're exhausted, that it's all meaningless and pointless. But if you just change one person's life for the better once a month, then that cumulatively is a life well lived. And I really exhorted her to have a practical, philosophical approach to the application of labor she's about to enter when she dedicates her life to being a doctor. And I think the same applies to apply in journalism. You need a practical, philosophical approach where you say, okay, I will not be paid a lot of money. I will not necessarily always get the accolade and the thanks that I feel I deserve. My stories may not always land in the way that I want them to land, but maybe occasionally, whether it's, so like this weekend I'm being invited to Julian Assange's wedding reception. And I worked with Julian Assange, I worked with him, you know, just over a decade ago on WikiLeaks, and we worked together very tightly on WikiLeaks, and we produced powerful evidence of human rights abuses and war crimes being committed in Iraq. And that is a standout point in the life of my journalism. But other smaller standout points are, you know, the journalism I did that exposed a child brothel in southern India, or the story that I worked on that revealed counterfeit pharmaceutical manufacturing production plants in India that were selling counterfeit pharmaceuticals into Nigeria and causing that factory to be shut down. These small victories, as well as the big victories, can I believe ultimately add up over a lifetime and lead to a position where you feel, you know, yes, it was hard. Yes, I may have given some personal sacrifices, but finally, you know, when the great reckoning comes, maybe I did a little bit more good than I did bad. And if all of us try to live a life where our ultimate reckoning, when we added up the calculus of our lives and found out there were more pluses than minuses, maybe in that moment, the world ultimately shifts towards a better place for all.
Thank you so much, Ian. Thank you so much for your time, for your knowledge. And I mean, your work is so important, Ian. And I know that your daughter surely looks up to you and everything that you do. But I'm so grateful that Radhika as well, my own daughter, has people like yourself to look up to. And every time I come on the podcast and I speak to people, I'm just so grateful that we still have people trying to create some good in the world, whether it's a small thing or a big thing. And that makes me very happy considering what's happening around us. So thank you for everything that you do, Ian, and all the best with everything tomorrow. I hope it all goes to plan, and I hope you get the result that you want.
Thank you. And I will definitely be tweeting out this podcast and letting people know the outcome of this week's court case.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. And of course, a big, big thank you to Ian for sharing your wisdom and your knowledge of everything you've learned over the years and trying to condense and distill that all into 1 hour. As I said, I've left all of the links to Ian's work in the show notes below. You can find more of my episodes on my website, aminalviz.com. And please do subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. It really does help us to reach out to more people. You can also subscribe to my newsletter on my website, where I share everything that I've learned over the weeks of speaking to these incredible, incredible people. Have a lovely week ahead, and I'll see you all next Friday.